Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 91.7 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on dozens of radio stations in different US and European cities. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1178, I will have a few segments. First, we will listen to the latest electronic intifada newscast covering the ongoing Israeli genocide, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing in occupied Palestine. During the second segment, I will air a conversation between United States Senator Chris Van Hollen and retired U.S. Army veteran and Green Beret Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Aguilar about the catastrophe in Gaza and what Anthony Aguilar witnessed firsthand in Gaza while working as a security contractor for the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Let's begin with the electronic intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 678 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombed and attacked areas across Gaza this week, killing at least 564 Palestinians and injuring nearly 3,100 between August 6th and August 13th, according to official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. The number of casualties among starving people trying to access food aid has increased to nearly 1,900 killed and approximately 13,600 injured since May 27th, when Israel and the U.S. opened its private so-called aid distribution sites, opening fire on crowds every day since. On Wednesday, Israeli forces killed at least 100 Palestinians, the health ministry reported, including 61 in attacks in Gaza City, as Israel's destruction of northern Gaza intensifies. 37 starving people were killed on Wednesday while trying to obtain food aid. An airstrike in the Zeitoun neighborhood of Gaza City on August 11th killed an entire family, the only survivor being a young girl named Loreen An-Nadim, who was trapped beneath the rubble, pinned against a mattress that Loreen said was her parents' bed. The Palestinian Civil Defense recorded her rescue. That's from the Civil Defense on August 11th. Their spokesperson, Mahmoud Basal, said that air raids on Gaza City have been steadily intensifying for days, as the Israeli army is using bombs, drones, and highly explosive munitions that cause massive destruction to residential buildings. The Civil Defense stated earlier this week that one of its firefighters was killed in his family's tent shelter in Al-Mawasi in central Gaza. More than 135 rescue workers with the Civil Defense have been killed over the past 22 months. Israel's escalations of attacks in Gaza City this week killed at least 7 children in a single airstrike on a building in the Zeitoun neighborhood on Sunday, August 10th. In an extremely graphic video, the bodies of 7 small children, most of whom appear to be babies and toddlers, lay bloodied and strewn on the floor at a hospital as family members mourned over them. Later that evening on August 10th, Israel directly attacked a journalist tent in the courtyard of El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, assassinating 6 broadcast reporters and photojournalists as Israel's hunting and targeted killings of high-profile witnesses to its crimes of genocide continue with impunity. Al Jazeera's Anas Al-Sharif, a 28-year-old reporter who millions in Palestine and around the world relied on every day for his coverage, was killed alongside the network's correspondent Mohamed Kareka, their cameramen Ibrahim Zahir and Mohamed Nofal, journalists Mu'amman Aliwa and Mohammed Al-Khaldi, and Saad Jundia, a Palestinian civilian who happened to be present. This clip was recorded just moments after the airstrike, when friends and colleagues of the reporters and their community realized that they had been killed. They tried to retrieve the journalists' shredded bodies as their clothes were still on fire. That was filmed just moments after the airstrike on the journalist's tent at Al-Shifa Hospital. Just 3 weeks ago, Anas Al-Sharif's appeal to all international press freedom and human rights organizations to do something to intervene against renewed threats against him by the Israeli military. He stated on July 23rd, quote, "Once again, the Israeli army spokesperson has launched a campaign of threats and incitement against me because of my work as a journalist with Al Jazeera. I reaffirm, I, Anas Al-Sharif, am a journalist with no political affiliations. My only mission is to report the truth from the ground, as it is, without bias." Al-Sharif's friend and fellow reporter Ibrahim Nofal, whose brother Mohammed was killed in the airstrike on August 10th, had filmed Anas Al-Sharif reacting to the video of Israeli military spokesperson Avichai Adrai, who openly threatened Al-Sharif on social media. Anas watches the video on a phone, in a tent, surrounded by his colleagues. He says, quote, "I really don't know, Ibrahim, what this guy wants from me. He wants me to stop covering the news. He wants me to stop covering the massacres that are happening. Despite that, I will continue until my last breath. Whether he threatens me or wants to bomb me, the mission will continue until the last breath, God willing. God willing, we are not afraid."
هذا بعمل لك دعاية بس
عبدتش أي حاجة من المجازر اللي بتصير ورغم هيك إن شاء الله مكملين لآخر نفس يهدد بده يقصف الرسالة راح تظلها مستمرة لآخر نفس إن شاء الله
بإذن الله.
Anas Al-Sharif and his colleagues who were murdered on August 10th in their tent at Al-Shifa Hospital are six of at least 238 reporters and media workers killed by the Israeli army as the world powers and international agencies continue to fail the Palestinians of Gaza nearly 2 years into this genocide. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that Israel, quote, has turned its horrific 22-month war on the Gaza Strip into a slaughterhouse for Palestinian journalists, systematically targeting them and their workplaces in an effort to enforce a total media blackout across the enclave. Anas Al-Sharif's final broadcast for Al Jazeera aired earlier in the day, focused on tiny children who were suffering from Israel's deliberate starvation policy. Al-Sharif, wearing his press vest and helmet, reported from a Gaza City hospital and told the stories of each child in the ward in a harrowing 4-minute report. Later that evening, Al-Sharif posted the following, quote, "The occupation is threatening to invade Gaza seriously, and the city has been bleeding for 22 months under the fire of land, sea, and air. Its martyrs number in the tens of thousands and its wounded in the hundreds of thousands. And if this madness does not stop, nothing will remain of Gaza but rubble, and the image and voice of its people will fade away, and history's memory will record you as silent witnesses to a genocide crime that no one did anything to stop." Minutes before he was killed, Anas Al-Sharif posted 13 seconds of video of heavy bombing in Gaza City. He captioned this clip, quote, "Relentless bombardment. For 2 hours, the Israeli aggression has intensified on Gaza City." Two days earlier, on Friday, August 8th, Anas Al-Sharif documented an airstrike on homes in western Gaza City. While he was being hunted by the Israelis and while the Israeli government announced that they were planning to intensify their obliteration of northern Gaza. Quote, "Night and day, the Israeli raids on Gaza do not stop," he wrote, "and this is one of them. just moments ago targeting a house west of Gaza City. In April of this year, just days after Israel assassinated his colleague, 23-year-old Hossam Shabat, in a targeted drone strike, Anas al-Sharif wrote his last will and testament to be published upon his death. I'll read excerpts of it here. "This is my will and my final message. If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. God knows I gave every effort and all my strength to be a support and a voice for my people ever since I opened my eyes to life in the alleys and streets of the Jabalia refugee camp. My hope was that God would extend my life so I could return with my family and loved ones to our original town of occupied Ascalon, Al-Majdal. But God's will came first and his decree is final. I have lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times, yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that God may bear witness against those who stayed silent, those who accepted our killing, those who choked our breath, and whose hearts were unmoved by the scattered remains of our children and women, doing nothing to stop the massacre that our people have faced for more than a year and a half. I entrust you with Palestine, the jewel in the crown of the Muslim world, the heartbeat of every free person in this world. I entrust you with its people, with its wronged and innocent children who have never had the time to dream or live in safety and peace. Their pure bodies were crushed under thousands of tons of Israeli bombs and missiles, torn apart and scattered across the walls. I urge you not to let chains silence you, nor borders restrain you. Be bridges toward the liberation of the land and its people, until the sun of dignity and freedom rises over our stolen homeland. I entrust you to take care of my family. I entrust you with my beloved daughter Shem, the light of my eyes, whom I never got the chance to watch grow up as I had dreamed. I entrust you with my dear son Salah, who I had wished to support and accompany through life until he grew strong enough to carry my burden and continue the mission. I entrust you with my beloved mother, whose blessed prayers brought me to where I am, whose supplications were my fortress, and whose light guided my path. I also entrust you with my lifelong companion, my beloved wife, Salah Bayan, from whom the war separated me for many long days and months. Yet she remained faithful to our bond, steadfast as the trunk of an olive tree that does not bend, patient, trusting in God, and carrying the responsibility in my absence with all her strength and faith. I urge you to stand by them, to be their support after God Almighty. If I die, I die steadfast upon my principles. Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance." Condolences and messages of grief and love poured in from Anas al-Sharif's colleagues, from friends, and from people across Gaza and around the world. Reporter Ahmed al-Najjar in Khan Yunis told Al Jazeera on Tuesday that the targeted airstrike on the agency's staff was the most devastating loss Gaza's journalist community has faced. Journalist Salah al-Jafarawi mourned Anas al-Sharif and posted this video of their reunion during the so-called ceasefire in January of this year. That was from journalist Saleh al-Jafarawi. Anas al-Sharif, 28 years old, was buried in Gaza City along with his colleagues. Mohammed Koreka, a correspondent for Al Jazeera who was also killed in the airstrike on the reporter's tent at Al-Shifa Hospital, was the only son of his parents. In 2024, Israeli forces executed his mother, who sought shelter and medicine at Al-Shifa Hospital during the second assault on the compound, according to his colleague Nur Oda. Mohammed was killed a few steps away from the crime scene of his mom's murder, Oda said. Koreka was described by his wife as extremely devoted to his mother, to his children, and to her. Quote, "We were unnaturally close," she said. "He spent his time between his work and his home. He dedicated his life to his wife and children. Mohammed and Anas had a very strong relationship, but we never expected them to meet the same end. Meanwhile, as Israel slaughters professional eyewitnesses to its crimes, Western and regional states continue to send lethal airdropped parcels of food aid instead of forcing Israel to open the crossings to the 22,000 aid trucks that remain blocked. On Saturday, August 9th, an airdropped box fell on a child in central Gaza, killing him instantly. The day before, on August 8th, an aid parcel landed on top of people and severely injured 19-year-old Karam al-Kahlout as he was trying to obtain water for his disabled father. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, standing at the teenager's bedside in the hospital, called for stopping the airdrops and instead ensure aid delivery through official crossings, quote, in a safe and organized manner, guaranteeing it reaches those in need without endangering civilians' lives. This is what we've been warning about since the Israeli occupation agreed to the Arab countries' airdrops to Gaza, Bassal stated. The Gaza government media office stated on August 9th that at least 23 Palestinians have been killed and 124 wounded from these airdrops since the beginning of the genocide. Euromed Human Rights Monitor released statistics on the exact amount of aid that has been dropped so far. From July 26th to August 11th, only 1,218 aid packages were dropped onto Gaza, the human rights group stated. Quote, Gaza's actual need is around 600 trucks of aid every single day to stop famine and begin recovery. Over 17 days, that equals to 10,200 trucks. Since one truckload equals 30 airdropped packages, Gaza requires about 18,000 packages each day. The 1,218 packages dropped in that period equal just 40.6 truckloads in total, or an average of only 2.4 trucks per day, a mere 0.4% of what is actually needed. At this rate, it would take 250 days of airdrops to deliver the same amount of aid Gaza requires in a single day, Euromed said. However, Denmark, in coordination with the United Arab Emirates and Jordan, announced that it would start participating in lethal airdrops, joining the UK, Canada, France, and Spain, among other countries who have decided to turn to public relations management instead of physically stopping Israel's genocide, starvation, and siege on Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli forces at the Gaza boundary crossings and Israeli and American mercenary forces operating the private so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites continue to trap, injure, and kill starving Palestinians every day. Doctors Without Borders released a report this week titled, "This is not aid, this is orchestrated killing," which draws on medical data, patient testimonies, and firsthand medical witnessing, quote, to demonstrate that what has been branded as aid distribution is in fact a system of institutionalized starvation and dehumanization. Joining similar calls by Palestinian civil society and United Nations agencies, the human rights group called for the immediate dissolution of the GHF distribution mechanism and urged states and private donors to refrain from funding what is essentially a death trap. And Israeli forces continue to target starving Palestinians at crossings in northern Gaza, who try to obtain limited amount of food aid, and those who are working to protect the aid from armed Israel-backed gangs. Euromed Monitor's Maha Husseini reported on Wednesday that an Israeli airstrike targeted a group of security personnel, killing 12 and injuring dozens more. Husseini said that, quote, for weeks, aid has been looted by armed gangs operating under the protection of Israeli forces. Gangs are allowed to access areas where regular citizens are barred. Security personnel were deployed today, Wednesday, to protect aid and ensure it reached UN and international organizations' warehouses. They have now been targeted again, she said. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza reported on Wednesday that it recorded 8 deaths due to starvation in a 24-hour period, including 3 children. This brings the total number of victims of Israel's starvation to 235, including 106 children. Reporter Moaz Abu Taha interviewed Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah at Nasser Medical Complex this week, who talked about his 2-year-old patient, Sham Koide, who weighs just 4 kilograms, less than 9 pounds.
Sham is 2 years old. Now she's in the hospital. Her weight is just 4 kilograms. Her weight should be 12 kilograms. She lost nearly 8 kilograms from her actual weight. She's complaining from severe acute malnutrition. As we can see, she just have the skin over the bone. The muscles are lost. The fat tissue is lost. She's dehydrated. She has sunken eyes. She's apathic. She's irritable. She's anxious. She has severe distended abdomen. She has hepatomegaly. She has signs of rickets due to vitamin D deficiency, rachitic rosary, still open anterior fontanelle, irritability, wide broadening of the lower limbs and the upper limbs. So she need to evacuate it outside as soon as possible to be diagnosed.
That was Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. Mohammed Zakout, Gaza's director of general hospitals, told Al Jazeera Arabic that, quote, these cases will soon be in the thousands if nothing changes. Children are among the weakest and most vulnerable to malnutrition. We have no treatments to save them, not even intravenous feeding, which is used in emergency cases like those we are seeing now. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight the story of the last date in Gaza by Asim Al-Nabi, writing from Gaza City. Quote, it's just a date, a single 4-centimeter piece of dried fruit. But here in Gaza, where nothing comes easily and everything holds meaning, even a date becomes a symbol of endurance, sacrifice, and love. I kept this date for 6 months. I'd found it and saved it for what I imagined would be the darkest days, the days when food would disappear from the shelves, when starvation would wrap itself around our lives, when sharing even a crumb would become an act of resistance. Those days are now. No one in my family wanted to eat the last date and deny someone else its sweetness. That's who we are in Gaza, not just survivors, but givers. We give even what little we have left, not because we are saints, but because love and dignity are all we can hold on to when everything else has been taken from us. War can reveal the worst in people. Here in Gaza, it also brings out the best. Our streets are filled with pain and rubble, but also with kindness. Small gestures like passing along a date speak volumes about who we are. Some may say it's just a date, but I see in it the whole of Gaza's story. Deprivation and generosity, despair and defiance, the tight knots of family and the unwillingness to surrender to cruelty. This date, saved and shared, is a tiny act of rebellion in the face of a system trying to strip us of everything, even the right to nourish our children. In Gaza, we have redefined wealth. Wealth is not what you hoard, but what you give away, and is measured in the strength of the bonds that hold families and neighbors together. In a world that tries to reduce us to statistics, we have become storytellers. A single date carries the story of a family's love, a child's survival, a father's absence, and a people's refusal to stop being human. People ask how we survive, how we keep going when the bombs keep falling, when hunger gnaws at our children, when there is no certainty that we'll live to see the next sunrise. My answer is, we survive for one another. We survive because in Gaza, no one wants to eat the last date. And we survive because we are all dreaming that a day might come soon with freedom and an abundance of dates. The date is gone now, eaten by a child too young to know what it means. But the act remains, rippling outward like a pebble cast into water. It is in these ripples, in the stories we tell, in the way we refuse to forget, that Gaza lives on. Those are excerpts from the story of the last date in Gaza by Asim Al-Nabi, writing from Gaza City on electronicintifada.net. Asim is a father, an engineer, and a PhD researcher, and serves as the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. A new assessment by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the UN's Satellite Center revealed this week that 98.5% of cropland in the Gaza Strip is either destroyed in no-go zones imposed by the Israeli military or both. Palestinians have stewarded, cared for, and made fruitful the entirety of that land for millennia, of course. But in a tiny corner of the 1.5% of land that they can still access and reclaim for food production as Israel's starvation on Gaza accelerates, members of the Samir Project, a mutual aid organization in Gaza, recorded video of an abundance of cucumber and zucchini plants, along with tomatoes, growing in the sunshine across about 2.5 acres. This was the product of a collaboration between the Samir Project and the Arab Group for the Protection of Nature, an organization that aims to protect, sustain, and reestablish sovereignty over Palestine's natural resources and food. And finally, musician and music teacher Ahmed Mouin led a song with his students, using the incessant drones overhead as instruments. The song, Kariat Jamal Kariat, Mouin says, is a call to lift the weight of truth, the voice of courage, and the spirit that refuses to be silenced.
One, how are you? I miss you a lot, really. Today there's a lot of drones. I'm gonna sing a song today with drone. Ah, shil shil ya jamali shil ya hawatak baladam shayid ma'attar bil hil hil ya lilu wail wail abdalimi wail wail min Allah la sar ala nujum al-layl ana nadilu shil shil ya jamali shil ya hawatak baladam shayid ma'attar bil hil hil ya lilu wail wail abdalimi wail wail min Allah la sar ala nujum al-layl ana nadilu shil shil ya jamali shil ya حوطك بلاد الشهيد معطر بالهيل يا ليل وين وين الظالمي وين 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 لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا نبيل شيل شيل على زمالي شيل يا حوطك بلاد الشهيد معطر بالهيل يا ليل وين وين الظالمي وين 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 لا أسهر على
is Ahmed Mouin with his students, and that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. A retired U.S. Army veteran and Green Beret Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Aguilar, who worked as a security contractor for the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF, that proved to be a U.S.-Israeli death trap for Palestinians desperately looking for food amid apartheid Israel's forced starvation for over 2.3 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, has been sharing his eyewitness account of atrocities he witnessed in Gaza against unarmed Palestinian civilians while working as a security contractor for the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. U.S. Senator for Maryland, Chris Van Hollen, conducted an interview with Anthony Aguilar about what he witnessed in Gaza, where he revealed during that interview that an Israeli officer ordered them to shoot starving Palestinian children at the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid site. I'm going to air now the full interview Senator Chris Van Hollen conducted with retired U.S. Army veteran and Green Beret Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Aguilar, sharing what he witnessed in Gaza. I highly recommend you listen to this segment in its entirety.
Well, thank you for getting together and at least start by thanking you for your service in the U.S. military. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your prior service. I also know you come from a military family.
I do, yes, sir. So I do come from a military family, and I ultimately made the decision to join the military. I attended the United States Military Academy at West Point. I was commissioned as an infantry officer. Mm-hmm. Upon my commission, I immediately deployed to combat Iraq the first time, Afghanistan, and many. So in my 25-year career, I have 12 combat deployments to places all over the world, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, the like. And 2008, I decided that I wanted to try out and join Special Forces. Mm-hmm. So I went to selection at Fort Bragg, and I became a Green Beret. So the remaining of my career, I was a U.S. Army Green Beret. And
so you've seen a lot of combat.
Seen a lot of combat, sir.
And you mentioned a couple of places, Afghanistan, where else?
Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Tajikistan. I was also deployed to Operation Enduring Freedom in Southeast Asia in the Philippines and fighting the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. Yeah. So I was in the Philippines, also Thailand, Malaysia, Cambodia, and then other Central Asian countries, small stint in Kazakhstan.
And, yeah. And then you signed up for this effort that they were saying was going to help feed people in Gaza. What made you decide you wanted to try to do that?
Well, sir, I had been familiar with the situation in Gaza. I had never been deployed to Israel or anything in nature that was involved in it, but reading the news and keeping up with what's going on. And, you know, the motto of Special Forces is De Oppresso Liber, to free the oppressed. So that motto isn't something that I just sit to the side when I got out of the Army. It's something that I live by. And so I felt that, you know, people that are starving, that need food, that are hungry, that are dying, that sounds like oppression to me. And I wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah. And so you became engaged in that. And then based on what you saw, you decided to come forward and speak out. So yes, why are you speaking out now?
So on the 14th of June, I terminated my contract. I made my reasons explicitly clear. I'm coming out now because I feel that it's important that the American people know from a trusted and reliable source, from someone that was there. I spent days on every site of this secure distribution sites in Gaza that are run by the GHF, all four sites. I spent days on end at all four of those sites. I spent days on end in an armored vehicle doing the delivery of aid. And the American people need to know what the United States is involved in Gaza. We're not bystanders. We are a part of it. U.S. tax dollars are going towards this effort. Americans are on the ground, armed, in Gaza, engaging with Palestinians and involved in things that America needs to know about.
What specifically do people need to know is happening right now as a result of the GHF operation?
The American people need to be aware that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation method of aid distribution was is inherently dangerous. It lures Palestinians into active war zones throughout Gaza to get food that they need. Under the UN method, there were 400 sites. Now there's only four. All four of those sites are co-located with Israeli positions in active combat zones. That's not humanitarian. By design, it is inherently dangerous. By execution, it is failing. It failed to launch. It hasn't achieved success. It is not achieving success now. It has failed. It is failing. And it will not succeed because it's not run by people that know anything about humanitarian assistance, humanitarian aid, or this type of work. It would be if someone asked me to do brain surgery. I'm educated, but I can't do that.
Absolutely. And we've seen and heard about these stories of very hungry, starving Palestinians having to crowd around toward these four centers to get food.
Yes, sir.
And in the process have been subject to fire, being shot.
Yes.
By IDF soldiers and others. Have you witnessed any of that?
I have witnessed it on all four locations with my own eyes. I have not only bear witness to it, touched it, felt it, heard it there on the ground right in front of me. I also captured a lot of it on video and on photos. And the proof is undeniable. And the proof is not videos and pictures alone. The proof is also witness, which is me. And I know what I saw. I'm a man of integrity. I've served my country and I've proven that, and I can be trusted. So what I saw on numerous occasions are the Israeli Defense Forces firing into the crowds of the Palestinians, firing over their head, firing at their feet, firing into the crowd. Not just with rifles or machine guns, but tanks, tank rounds, artillery, mortars, missiles. Not because they were combatants or because they were hostile or because they were Hamas, but simply as a means to control the crowd. Why I say that the process under GHF is inherently dangerous is because those crowds are the size that the crowds are because of the process of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and how we're delivering aid. There's only four sites.
Yeah, compared to 400.
Compared to 400. Mm-hmm. More importantly is that no one in Gaza City and Jabalia, where right now I think it is, everybody can agree, is the most vulnerable population going into starvation and famine. There are no distribution sites from GHF north of the Netzarim corridor at all. They're all south of the Netzarim corridor. No one from Gaza City or north of the Netzarim corridor can go south of the Netzarim corridor. So the entire vulnerable population that the world has pulled the alarm on, that is in the time of crisis and on the verge of famine, can't get to any of the aid. Can't even get to it. And we're not taking it to them. So in order to reach each of these sites, throughout all of the rest of Gaza, central to south Gaza, there are only four sites, and three of them are all the way in the south, located right in the middle of the IDF's Operation Gideon's Chariots, which is an offensive operation. Not security, not defense, but an offensive war that these civilians have to walk through, and they get shot at. They get shot at by the IDF, and unfortunately, they get shot at by American contractors on the ground.
And you've witnessed this directly.
I have witnessed it. I would, one of the photos that I took, sir, was this photo here. This young boy, his name is Amir. Mm-hmm. I know that because he and I talked. I took this photo. I get a little emotional with this because this is on secure distribution site one on the 27th of May. The second day we had done distribution. Mm-hmm. At this point, the second in charge of the entire contract resigned in protest based on how distribution went on the 26th of May on day one. He notified the leadership. He said, I can't be a part of this anymore. We continued. This young man on this site, as you can see, he doesn't have a box. He's carrying things that he found on the ground. Because on the sites, it became a free-for-all. It became a survival of the fittest. The Gaza Olympics. Yeah. Hunger Games.
Hunger Games.
Dystopian to the 10th degree. It's horrible. There was no box for this young man, so he picked up some things that he found on the ground, and he was so thankful for even that, and he walked up to me, and he extended his hand, and I beckoned for him to come forward, and he grabbed my hand, and he kissed my hand, and he said, Shukran, Shukran. And he was sincere. He was crying. He walked 8 kilometers to get there. No shoes.
Yeah.
Probably hasn't eaten in days. So for anybody that says that the people of Gaza are not starving, I beg to differ. I've seen different. This young man, he held my hand and he kissed it, and I kneeled down to look at him in the face so I can let him know that, you know, people care. You're not alone. People care. and he set down his bags and he put his hands on my face and he kissed me. And he looked at me and he said, Shukran. And I was like, you're welcome. And he says, thank you. And he picked up his bags and he went back to join this group. And this was the last remaining group of people on the site that were picking up remnants of aid. And he left through the exit of site number one. The exit of site number one goes north to the Marag corridor, which is a combat area, a fighting area.
Yeah.
The IDF opened up with machine gun fire into the crowd to get them to leave faster, to get them to hurry. Shooting at their feet, shooting over their heads, shooting into the berm. There's video of this. It's been verified. That's the first time I had experienced such use of force against, so I didn't know what was going on because he had walked through the berm and I heard the shooting. So I ran up to the berm to look and there were dead Palestinians. He was one of them.
Oh my God.
So.
The boy who just kissed you.
Who said thank you.
Yeah.
Who wasn't a threat. The people that we promised that we're going to bring food to, that we're going to feed. Not only are we not feeding them adequately, we're not providing enough. By right now, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has achieved 82 million meals delivered into Gaza. They've been doing that over 60 days of distribution. So at the rate of what the UN was doing, they are operating at a performance rate of 3%. 3%.
Compared to what was...
Not 3% below.
Delivered to the other, yeah.
3%, period. If the amount of aid that the UN was delivering, 500 to 600 trucks a day, let's just say 500 trucks a day is the mark. UG Solutions, SRS, GHF are delivering 18 trucks a day on average. We're starving people.
At just four sites.
At just four sites. And in order to get to it, the people getting to it have to endure gunfire, have to endure an 8 to 12 kilometer walk one way to get there.
Yep.
And then after they receive aid from the site, they can't go back home. Because once you're west of the Magan Oz corridor or north of the Marag corridor between the coastal corridor, you can't leave. So all of these people, if you're in Khan Yunis and you head south to get aid, because site number four is not open that day, which is common. They're not all open. So on any given day, there's only one or two open. So if they can't get aid at site four and they want to go down south to get site one, they then are stuck down there. They're displaced. They can't go home. They go to the Nasser camp or they go to the Mawasi refugee camp.
Yeah.
They can't go home. So the United States... Not just UG Solutions, not just Safe Reach Solutions, not just the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. The United States of America is complicit in setting mouse traps with cheese of the food is the bait to bring them down and then displace them from the north.
So this is, in your view, a big part of the displacement strategy that's going on right now.
It is the displacement strategy.
Yeah.
It is how it's being done. Now, did GHF or SRS or UG Solutions sign up to do that? I don't believe so. But even after the first day of being there, you don't have to be Clausewitz to figure out that if we're supposed to be distributing humanitarian aid, why aren't we building aid sites where the need is? If everybody's north, why are we building sites in the south? How do they get here? Oh, well, they walk. Oh, so they displace from where they live to come here to get food. And do they get to go back? No. So we're displacing people. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
And we're a part of it. The United States government, through its $30 million to the State Department, to GHF, the American taxpayer, Americans that are on the ground with guns, we are complicit in the displacement of a population of people, innocent, starving people who we say, we're here to feed you. Come and get some food. And we use it as bait. And most of them don't survive.
Yeah, it's been horrible reading about what's happening. I see you have some other things here, a video. Is there anything else you want to
Just a couple things here I wanted to show you. So this young boy, I talked to him. This is your typical Palestinian when they reach the site, how thankful they are. Yeah. They're not a threat. Yeah. This gentleman here gave me the peace sign, and then he kissed at me and he said, thank you. This young boy right here, as I told you, this young boy on site number two, this young boy is picking up noodles with his bare hands because there were no boxes of aid. So with his right hand, he's picking up noodles that he's then shifting out to put in his backpack because that's all he got. His face is red and flushed because he got pepper sprayed in the face by a UG contractor.
You witnessed that?
Witnessed it. Saw it. That's why I took the picture.
Yeah.
This young girl, happy to be there. Some of us with our own money purchased cookies for the kids because the boxes just have rice, flour, fava beans, nothing that you can actually eat until you cook it.
Yeah.
So we bought cookies for the kids. This girl has a package of cookies. These packages are a pack of packages, and she took the whole thing for me, and I was like, okay. She took it and then opened it and was handing it out to other children. These are the Palestinians. These are the people of Gaza. This isn't Hamas. This isn't a bad guy. This could be my daughter.
Yeah.
Or mine. These aren't the criminals.
Yeah.
This man here picking up a bag of flour, I took this photo. He's thanking me. Not a threat. This young girl here, this is at site number four.
Yeah.
Distribution site four.
Yeah.
This is who we're starving. These people. Her.
Yeah.
That could be my neighbor.
Yeah.
This young boy right here. I mean, he even looks like my son. This could be my son. Thankful, happy. And this young boy didn't get any aid because by the time he got there, everything was gone. He was happy just for the fact, the idea that we were there to help. This is who we're starving. This is who's dying. This young boy, this is on site number one early in the morning. Happy to be there. He got one box. Him and his family got a box. Just happy. Never at any time on all four distribution sites at distributions through morning, afternoon, night, throughout the night, during the day, did I ever witness a threat, hostility, even anything close to hostility, ever, in the whole group.
Yeah.
Another picture of a young boy just thankful.
So absolutely no reason for anybody to be shooting at them.
No reason. This woman here, this is site one. She was hit in the head with a piece of shrapnel from a stun grenade that was thrown by a UG Solutions contractor. It hit her in the head and knocked her unconscious. Before she left that site, I was hit with it also.
You were hit?
With a piece of the stun grenade. I got stitches in my arm from it. I was wounded from it. And the gentleman that helped me up off the ground was a Palestinian man, the man that's here covering his face because the stun grenades have tear gas in them. So when they explode, not only do they fire these pellets, they also expend tear gas. And the gentleman helped me up, and then he went here to help the woman in black, help the woman in red onto the cart. I went up to thank him, and I said, thank you. And I placed my hand on her, motionless, lifeless. Unfortunately, throughout my life and my military career in war, I have touched and been next to a lot of dead people.
Yeah.
I would raise my right hand in a court of law and attest to the fact that she was dead. Not from the IDF, not from starvation, not from trampling because Hamas incited a stampede. We killed her. That's not the American way. This man here, this was on site number one. Again, early in the morning. He was on the ground picking up noodles. A UG contractor yelled at him and said, get out of here. He doesn't speak English. We don't speak Arabic. We only had one translator per site for thousands of people. So that's how we spent money. We spent money on a lot of guns and one translator. This man was then sprayed in the face with pepper spray and he was immobilized. This young man, this worker here is a local Palestinian worker who was dumping water on his face. And that wasn't done by the IDF. That wasn't done by Hamas. That was done by an American contractor who is there in a very complex and complicated environment trying to do the best he or she can with no rules of engagement, no standard operating procedures, No escalation of force procedures. None of this has been provided. And all of us, sir, are in Gaza. We are in Israel on a tourist visa.
Unbelievable.
We are in the country of Israel, in Gaza, carrying weapons.
On a tourist visa.
And doing this.
On a tourist visa.
And doing this. And doing this. And we are there on a tourist visa. If my grandmother wanted to go visit Jerusalem, she would go into Israel on the same way that I did, as a contractor with a gun.
Unbelievable. So who is like giving the orders for all the GHF operations?
Great question, sir. I was told very explicitly, directly to my face, that our client is the IDF.
Your client is the IDF.
Our client is the IDF. And this came out in a discussion once where I was in the control room. I was on I was on control room duty that day. We had shifted responsibilities on a rotational base. So I was in there that day with the radio observing site number 2 distribution. A Palestinian man had picked up some children to let them step on his shoulders to get onto a berm because they were being crushed in the crowd. Site 2 is very small, smallest of all 4 sites. And these children are being crushed, and he picked them up there and put them up on the berm. And the Israeli Defense Forces liaison officer in the main control center with us comes up to the screen that I'm watching, and he says, "Tell your men to get them down." I was like, "We got this under control." I was like, "I know they know what they're doing. Nope, you know, they're children. Let's calm down. Mm-hmm. Get them down now or I will." Well, there's no IDF on the site. So I didn't take it as much of like, much more than just being, you know, bombastic and like, okay, like, hey, we got this. He leaves and goes to his desk in the operations center, and he gets on the radio and he speaks something on the radio. It was in Hebrew. I don't speak Hebrew. One of the contractors that was there was American that did speak Hebrew, and he notifies me. He said, "Hey, he just told the snipers at the IDF position, because the site number 2 is co-located with an Israeli base." Mm-hmm. He said, "He just told the snipers to take these kids out." I was like, "On the radio?" He's like, "Yeah." This lieutenant colonel then comes back up and he says, "Get them down." And I look at him and I say, "Did you just call on the radio and tell your men to shoot them?" And he said, "I'm going to take care of this if you don't." And I said, "You are not going to shoot. You are not going to shoot children. You're also not going to shoot, because if your men miss, you're going to hit others. You're not going to shoot." Thank God we didn't come to the conclusion of figuring out whether he would or not, because the children jumped down and ran off of the site. They didn't want to be there. They were unarmed. They didn't have shoes. One wasn't even wearing a shirt. They were starving. The chief operations officer for S Safe Reach Solutions, our higher headquarters, so to speak, in the contract, beckoned me outside with him, and he looked at me in the face and he said, "Never say no to the client." And I asked him, I was like, "I didn't know the client was in there. Who's here? Did Johnny Moore come to visit?"
Right.
And he said, "No, the IDF." I was like, "The IDF are our client?" He said, "Yes, we work for them." A light bulb went off in my head, because up until that point, every day at 11 o'clock, mm-hmm. we'd have an operations meeting where the IDF, not Kogat, not the UN, not GHF, the IDF would give us very clear and explicit instructions. This is the site you will deliver to. This is how much aid you will deliver. This is how you will deliver it. This is the time you will deliver it. This is how many trucks will go in. They gave us explicit, and we took our marching orders from them. Up until that point, I just thought maybe that was just a process. But then I realized that, oh, according to Safe Reach Solutions, the prime contract, we work for the IDF. Inherently, a combatant, a belligerent in a war. Is Israel at war with Hamas? Absolutely. Are they combatants? Absolutely. Humanitarian aid should not be distributed through a humanitarian assistance mechanism that is controlled by a combatant in a war. It is inherently inhumane. It is inherently un-American. And if Americans knew that, I don't think they'd put up with it.
I think you're right. We talked earlier about how you've been involved in many combat situations on behalf of the United States. Have you ever seen a situation like you witnessed here in Gaza?
In 25 years of serving in the Army, sir, to include the fight against ISIS, who what I would say is a pretty barbaric enemy, never in 25 years have I witnessed or been a part of what I saw in Gaza. The death, the destruction, the injustice, the more so the use of escalation of force against an unarmed population of civilians. None of them were armed. They're starving. They're unarmed. They're women. They're children. They're old men. They're handicapped. They're human beings. Never in my entire military career and everywhere I've been, in situations from low intensity to high intensity, have I ever witnessed the barbaric use of force against an unarmed civilian population, ever. And I hope I never witness something like that again.
Well, I think your testimony is going to be important to make sure that the American people know what's happening.
Yes, sir.
Know how their tax dollars are being used. And I want to again thank you for your service in the U.S. military.
Yes, sir.
That requires bravery. It also requires courage to come out and talk about something you're witnessing here. Is there anything else that you want to say?
I appreciate your time, sir. I thank you for your service to our country. And as you said, that's my objective in this, is to inform the American people of what the truth is.
Yeah.
I have no agenda in this. I'm not in this for some greater cause. I recently retired from the military, very happy being a stay-at-home dad and making breakfast for my family and taking my son to a school and being a dad. I have no aims or objective in this other than, one, that the American people know the truth. Two, I swore an oath to this country, and that oath didn't get hung up with my uniform on the 1st of March. The Constitution is founded in values. This is not in line with American values, and Americans need to know that, sir.
They do.
What you just heard was an interview United States Senator Chris Van Hollen conducted with retired U.S. Army veteran and Green Beret Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Aguilar, sharing what he witnessed in Gaza. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.